Did you ever wonder what it would be like to be part of the SparkFile coaching community? Here's how the SparkFile community describes it.
The most honest, safe, life-affirming, and life-changing experience I've had in all my 55 years. The best.
I'm incredibly grateful to Laura and Susan for teaching me the tools and structures that I need to get past the fear and to just do it anyway.
The SparkFile is a portal to your creative powers and believing in yourself.
This group is spiritually, emotionally, mentally
supportive, creative,
amazing, encouraging,
life-shifting, and liberating.
Uber talented, warm, thoughtful, lovely, wonderful people.
I need a group like this to give me the kick in the ass that I need to start making the things that I want to make and do.
This big, beautiful, creative trampoline that just like catches you gently and just launches you out with so much love.
If you want to learn more about the SparkFile Creativity Coaching, including our 6-month Blaze course, visit thesparkfile.com/blaze and schedule a no pressure, no obligation call to find out what is possible and how we can support you. It's time to take it and make it.
The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content. Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. Pump it in my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
I jump into my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
Let's open up the SparkFile.
Oh, welcome to the SparkFile, your one-stop rehearsal hall for creative inspiration.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I am Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the 10 millionth time, welcome. If you're joining us for the first time, you are also welcome. But you may be asking yourself, what exactly is a SparkFile? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are good questions, and we have got answers.
A SparkFile is a place where you consistently collect all of your inspirations and fascinations.
But here's the deal. We are makers, and we are making all kinds of things all the time.
And if you're anything like us, and you're making stuff all the time, or you want to be making stuff all the time, you know the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry.
So we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up, lift ourselves up off of our asses, and make things like this very podcast.
Or a life-changing adventure that captivates the imagination of millions.
Or a space for you and maybe others to come together and create.
Ooh, I like that. Every episode, we're going to reach into the SparkFile and exchange some sparks. And from time to time, we're going to talk to some folks who spark us too.
And if you're not careful, you might lay the groundwork for creativity itself. So without further ado, let's open up
the SparkFile. Oh, nice.
Bringing it to the mid-century.
Hello.
Jingle.
I like it.
Cams.
Blackwell.
How you doing, baby Cams?
I'm good. I'm really good. I'm excited to share some sparks.
Spark Day is always a favorite day.
Spark Day is the best day.
Before we dig in and open up our spark file,
yeah.
I just want to share something that came to us over the gram.
Oh.
That's the Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
From a listener who has the Instagram username Andy C. Pugh, P-U-G-H.
Andy
recently posted that this has been a long time in the making, not because it's particularly difficult, just reasons. There are a number of people to thank about what Andy's about to announce, and in no particular order, he included
us,
two wonderful ladies of the SparkFile, and acknowledged that what he was sharing was a creative risk. And what he was sharing is a new podcast that he is creating called Thoughts from the Tinkerage. Andy is a maker, and he, I think, has had a creative spark to rock a podcast.
Yes.
And he's starting.
I'm so excited.
I am too.
I love, like, Andy has been in touch with us and, like, just becoming aware of his work and what he does. And now that he's making a podcast, like, it just makes me feel proud and excited and happy for him.
I feel like there is this community of makers that we're just starting to tap into.
That's right.
And I am loving these people. I'm loving these people. There's a distinction that it feels like from the performing arts, which is where we do a lot of our making.
That's right.
And
they're like hands-on, like talking about the shop class in recent episodes. Yeah. When I see their stuff, I'm like, oh, you're doing it. You have a shop and you're making shit.
Yeah.
Tangible things with your hands.
Yes. Things that are not ephemeral and evaporate after that evening's performance. It's so great.
With subjective, qualifications and assessments.
Andy did say, listening to the Spark File, particularly hearing us ask guests about their recent creative risks, was the push that he needed to go on and make this podcast. And it's so interesting to hear different things strike different people. But I was like, yeah, I think there is something about hearing that very established, very esteemed makers, mm-hmm. hearing that it's still an ongoing risk for them.
That's right.
That sparks me too.
That's right. Yeah. And for some, it's even higher level risks than previously. And for others, it's like, I risked making a new recipe for my family and that felt scary for me. Yeah. You know, it's all and everything in between.
Yeah.
I love that.
We're proud of you, Andy.
Yes.
We cannot wait to subscribe, rate, 5-star review, support you.
Thoughts
love
from the Tinkerage.
And love Thoughts from the Tinkerage.
Yay.
Love that title.
I know.
Love it.
And I just love that his shop, that is his shop, basically, the Tinkerage.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's neat. So you can check him out on Instagram, too, and look at all the...
Yes, his Instagram handle for the podcast is at Thoughts from the Tinkerage. So...
Love it.
Support, love.
Props.
Joy. Check it out. But now for something completely different.
Somewhat different. Yeah, somewhat different.
What you got?
I'm going first.
You're going first?
I'm doing it. Suze. Have you ever been to Brazil? Have you traveled to Brazil?
I have not traveled to Brazil.
Girl.
Are you going to take me to Brazil now?
Kind of. I'm going to take you to Brazil like 100 years ago.
Oh,
but,
so we're not only traveling, we're time traveling.
We're time traveling to Brazil. But I had the pleasure of going to Brazil like 5 or 6 times thanks to my job at Blue Man Group.
Fantastic.
We opened a show there. The tour that we did, a megastar, like it was a rock concert, parody of a rock concert, but also a rock concert, and played in Sao Paulo and Rio. And I did, you know, the press openings for that. Mm. But then we also did a series of commercials, as celebrities sometimes do. When you don't want to do commercials in your own country, you do commercials in other countries.
That's right.
I was producing commercials for a phone company, Tim. It was the number 2 phone company in Brazil. And they had Blue Man as their spokespeople for a few years. So we traveled.
They're non-speaking spokespeople.
That's right.
Yeah.
For a telephone. That makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
But so I was able to go several times and... both to Rio and Sao Paulo. And around that time, I started to get completely fascinated with the Amazon.
Mm.
As you probably know, it's the largest rainforest on the globe. But there's still so much that we don't know about it. Mm. I mean, the canopy of trees is so thick. Like, you can't fly over it and see the ground. Nor, like, when you go into it, you can't see much of the sky. So it is, like, a really self-contained area. It's about the size of the continental U.S. So it is not a small...
Really?
Wow.
Yeah,
it's a big...
Still, market. Even with like...
Well, yeah. We'll get into that. That's not good. But until recently, like, there were still tribes that lived in the Amazon region that had never seen an airplane because you don't see the sky, right?
Oh, that's a neat...
Yeah, and there still may be tribes living in there that haven't seen airplanes.
But we might not know about it.
Well, we may not know.
Wow.
And it is, like you mentioned, it's absolutely devastating what is happening currently, the deforestation and the fires. And for me, the Amazon is a spark in and of itself. And maybe I might do a spark all about it. But this particular spark today is about a man who is responsible for much of what we do know about the Amazon. This man was a renowned geographer, archaeologist, cartographer, and his work redefined the map of South America, literally. He believed he had discovered an ancient civilization deep in the heart of the Amazon. And in 1925, he went in search of this city. He took his son and his son's best friend into the jungle and was never seen or heard from again.
This is...
It's amazing.
This story is very promising. The spark is...
Just you wait.
Okay.
So just like Amelia Earhart, Jimmy Hoffa, Michael Rockefeller, and D.B. Cooper, like the disappearance of this man, Lieutenant Colonel Percival Harrison Fawcett, became a fascination for millions of people around the world. Mm. And I would like to introduce you to Colonel Percy Fawcett today.
I'm so here for this. Remind me, you just said 1925?
Is when he went on his final mission.
Okay, got it. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So in 1901, Fawcett graduated from the Royal Geographical Society's training program as an explorer skilled in surveying and navigation and first aid and a variety of survival skills like foraging for food. He also trained at the Royal Military Academy, and eventually he was a decorated hero in World War I. But he was this fearless, larger-than-life character.
Royal British?
British.
Got it.
So he was British. He was married to a woman named Nina Agnes Patterson. They had three children, Jack, Brian, and Joan. Sidespark here. Ever since I saw All Is Lost, that Shakespeare...
Kenneth Branagh,
Judy Dench. Movie, and learning that Shakespeare's wife couldn't read.
Yeah.
Like, that blew my mind. Yeah. And now I just, like, I want to know about the spouse of every single one of the men that we learn about.
Fascinating.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, sidespark there. I just think they have incredible stories to tell. Like, what we know about her is that she was the daughter of a colonial judge. She was strong-willed and independent. She was an advocate for women's rights in the early 1900s.
Wow.
And we know that her husband left for months, if not years at a time, while she was raising these kids, and her husband's adventures were broadcast around the world. So I just think she's got a fascinating story
to
tell.
Yeah.
She's a spark. Now, to set the stage, the time frame.
I love this moment.
The time frame is the early 1900s,
just
100 years ago. The world is fixated on the idea of mapping the globe, and the Amazon is one of the largest blank spots left.
Fascinating.
Nobody knows anything about, literally.
Fascinating.
And part of that was because the jungle was so thick, like a person couldn't just walk in and look around. Like I said, it's about the size of the continental U.S., so it was a very significant part of the globe that people just didn't know anything about, and it couldn't be penetrated by the outside world.
Yeah.
So around 1906, the countries of Bolivia and Peru didn't even know the boundaries of their own country because it was somewhere in the Amazon. So they were like, we'd like to get a little more specific about where our country starts and ends, right?
That is amazing. That's an amazing thing in and of itself, that the very country is sort of like, and then we think just
past the bend, around the bend.
Maybe to the border of the river. Like,
exactly.
The other thing that I'm struck by, don't want to jump your spark.
No.
But how the very significant work of nameless people that in many cases are not Percy Fawcett, in many cases are sort of lost to history.
That's right.
For the most part, that the significant work that they have done create the foundation for our modern world that we totally take for granted.
Lives lost, like we will never know. People gave their life to map the globe.
Passionate
you just
about
look
this
at a
work.
Map and you're like, meh, meh, meh. But it's... I don't know why you make
a map
that.
And you make a Muppet sound.
I don't know why, but I do.
But yes, we just take it for granted.
Yeah, you just take for granted that we've always known this about the globe.
I love this. Sorry to...
Yay, I'm so happy. So Bolivia and Peru, because they didn't know the boundaries of their countries, they consulted with the Royal Geographical Society to see if there was anyone who might want to map it. They believed it was a suicide mission. So they were like, I don't know who the hell's going to go in there and do this.
What an inquiry.
Yes.
We'd love for somebody from your organization to map this. We do believe it's a suicide mission.
And, you know, Colonel Fawcett
was like,
immediately volunteered.
I'm your man.
He was the guy. So he first ventured into the Amazon in 1906 to survey the border between Brazil and Bolivia. And over the course of several years, he traveled repeatedly to the region for like two decades, I guess, mapping out these huge areas. But he came back, like, especially from his first trip, having like succeeded in his job, but also with these amazing tales of things that he did and saw, including his claims to have seen and shot a 62-foot anaconda. That's right.
Was he prone to exaggeration?
No.
Whoa.
No. And we know now, like, you could go now and film, and I don't want to say easily, because as I've learned, anacondas actually don't like to be seen. So they are a bit hidden. Yeah. You have to look for them, but you can find a 30-foot one.
It's not inconceivable that this was real.
It's not, especially like this is untouched territory.
We'll never know the answer to, probably. Who the fuck measured the anaconda and came up with 62 feet?
That's right. I don't know.
Suicide mission.
Well, he shot it. So,
You know, that's how.
That's right.
It's easier to measure. I would imagine it's easier to measure a dead
once
anaconda.
Once it's dead.
62 feet. If you like anaconda meat, that's a lot of meals.
That's a lot of meals. Yeah. It's incredible. But that story, of course, like there were some people that like, latched onto this new hero, and other people who are like, I rolled, that can't be possible. But he also claimed to find some unknown species, like this certain kind of a giant spider that no one had seen before.
Oh no.
Dogs with double noses. I have a picture I need to show you.
What?
Because of course that was also like, what do you mean dog? They sort of have these like double snouts, and there is a dog called the Andean tiger hound that has a double snout.
I wonder why evolution shaped that dog into having two noses. There's a reason for it.
There is a reason for it. And in the Amazon, there are a million things. I'm going to sidebar for... I'm going to save it. But there's other things. Like, there are just a million things that, frankly, the explorers, the white men from elsewhere, came in and would have no... Like, they couldn't conceive of certain ideas. Like, apparently there is a bird that can break through a stone with its beak, but only after like rubbing its beak in a certain leaf. So it would rub its nose in a leaf and then be able to like knock out some break stones. There are fish that, long time, I'm going to talk later about how like white men were like, frankly, like I get so excited about the spark that I'm just sort of like, oh no, I'm going to go all over the map.
I'm going to go on the record right now and say this is a Hall of Fame spark.
Oh my gosh, really? We haven't even like chipped the tip of the iceberg.
You're talking about dogs that have two snouts.
I mean,
you're talking about birds that have the ability, after consulting with a specific kind of foliage, to fucking break stones like they work on a chain gang. This is crazy.
That's the Amazon. A lot of people believe like the cure to cancer is in the Amazon because of the, like, we have no fucking idea.
Astounding. Please continue.
Okay, so another thing I'm going to talk about later is how the white men did not believe that it was even possible for an advanced civilization to have existed in the Amazon. One, because of racism, and they were like, these are savages that couldn't possibly have created a civilization. But the other was because they didn't think there was enough food to sustain a population.
You got 62 feet of anaconda meat.
Right there. But it's basically like the white people did not have any idea of how to capture the food. And so this is, I'm totally off road here, but this, like the bird, there's another story that Fawcett apparently discovered, because he would befriend the tribes of people if he could. I'll get into more of that later, but he found out, like, so there's a certain kind of fish that's very plentiful, and people would try to catch it and could not catch it for the life of them. And you're like, so frustrating. I'm so hungry and there's fish right here.
They're uncatchable.
Yeah. One of the Indian tribes showed him, there is a leaf. You take it and kind of crush it up into like a liquid until a liquid comes out. Pour that liquid into the water. The fish in that area will turn on their side and go like temporarily paralyzed. And you can just reach right into the water and pick them up and take them.
I literally have to, my jaw is on the table.
I mean, it's amazing. And so it's like just because we don't know.
Like, it sounds like magic.
It does sound like magic.
We're talking about a whole different set of rules for living.
Yes. Yes.
And those racist whites could not
conceive of it. No, no. And I mean, it's mind blowing. And this I still think it reminds me of like Hogwarts,
like potions class, yeah, where it's sort of like, no, if you just like crush this nut and like sprinkle it over the water,
that's right,
the fish will just like be like, turn belly up for a minute.
And you can and just it's reach easy right as pie in. To reach right in and get them.
But it's real life. This yep. is awesome. Please
so
continue.
He's so amazing. So this, his first expedition was super successful, and it led to several more. And he became renowned for his dedication, his endurance, and his courage. And newspapers across the globe would recount the tales of his travels, allowing people to like follow his adventures. So he was incredibly famous.
He's like a folk hero.
Yeah. Yes. He was super famous in that time. He helped to inspire the novel The Lost World by Arthur Conan Doyle, who you might remember I have mentioned before, because another person who is claimed to have inspired it is Teddy Roosevelt, who was a peer of Fawcett.
Okay.
Incredibly jealous and competitive of each other.
They sound like two
right?
big swinging dicks.
And,
yes.
And I read in more than one place that the Amazon was not big enough to contain both of their egos. So if that tells you anything.
You know, I don't know that I necessarily want to be in regular contact with guys like this, but they do get shit done.
They do get shit done.
You know, driven by this ego and this
and
jealousy.
And when I tell you in just a moment how dangerous it was, like, again, when you look at a map, you will realize like people lost their lives. Thousands and thousands of people lost their lives just so that we could know what is on this earth that we inhabit.
Wow.
So he was this colossal figure. He was seen as indestructible, which is important later because people don't believe that he actually could be dead. Like, he defied death in their mind.
Amazing.
He was incredibly brave and daring. So on one of his trips, he successfully tracked the source of the Rio Verde, which, you know, of that at that time, that was like one of the bigger things that you could do. Like, what's the source of the Nile? What's the source of these amazing like rivers that cut through an entire land? You still want to trace them. Can you trace them all the way back to their origins? And he did that, although this trip almost killed him.
Wow.
It killed half of the people that he was with. So the thing, what makes it so dangerous is that like the Amazon is literally filled with life ending encounters everywhere you turn.
Okay.
So there's those anacondas.
Poisons, things with sharp teeth.
That's right.
Yeah.
Anacondas, jaguars, spiders the size of chihuahuas. And I know you love chihuahuas,
aww,
but imagine a spider that size.
Adorable.
Not so much in my mind.
That, again, Harry Potter, it's very, there's a, this is.
Right? I mean, it really does engage the imagination because in the Amazon, especially at that time, you haven't seen any of these animals. You might see a drawing now of something and think, well, that can't be real.
But it's real. And it's also just a quick side spark. I think that dressing up my Chihuahua POTUS as an Amazonian spider would be a great Halloween costume. I'm sorry to interrupt. Spark
That's
included.
Important.
Go ahead.
Let's remember that. In the Amazon, there are also piranha.
Oh.
There are snakes that will eat you whole. There are snakes that will squeeze you to death. There are vampire bats that will bite on you all night long, and you wake up with blood dripping down your skin because they have just snacked on you all night.
Oh, man.
There are frogs the size of a coin that are so deadly to the touch. They have enough toxins to kill 100 people. There is a teeny microbe that can, if you're in the water, it's the tiniest thing that will swim up any orifice. That is
That's
right.
That's one of those
That's your vagina.
Yes.
Your penis.
Your penis.
It will swim right up, and those things can kill you. The greatest obstacle, though, are the insects. The mosquitoes transmit yellow fever, malaria, bone crusher fever, elephantitis.
Bone crusher fever.
I don't know. I meant to look that up, but I didn't. I'm sorry. I have no more information about it, but the name is enough.
Here's a spark. Bone crusher fever would be a great novelty disco song. I think it's going to be a big, big hit.
It's going to be a huge hit. Yeah. Huge hit. Bone crusher fever.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm on it. If only I wrote music. Elephantitis?
Elephantitis.
Elephantitis.
Wait. Mm-hmm. You can contract
elephantitis. From a mosquito.
Is something you contract?
Mm-hmm.
Fuck.
That's right.
I didn't know that.
And they had no immunities. They had no shots. They had nothing. So literally half the men would die. At least half the men would die on every trip.
If you are indigenous to the Amazon, do you already have tolerances for these things?
So that is a good question. And I did look into it a little bit. And no one has the answer to that. You can only assume so because there are tribes of people there who obviously cohabit with these mosquitoes, and they're not dying in the same way that the white people are who try to enter the Amazon.
Fascinating.
But it's definitely a mystery. So what exactly is it that makes them immune to some of these things? There are clouds of gnats that like bite you all night. So much so that you cannot sleep. So if you can imagine, like, you're exhausted from hacking your way with a machete through the jungle just enough so you can like pass through. They're doing that all day and getting maybe half or a quarter of a mile to half a mile per day. That's it. That's how long it takes.
Mm-hmm.
These gnats then keep you from sleeping. You're exhausted and hungry, and the gnats get in the food. The gnats are like, you can visually see the gnats' bellies are full of blood. And then they're like in your food, making your food really not palatable.
Unappetizing.
There is a bee, a tiny bee that is drawn to sweat. So remember, you're hacking through the jungle as if you're not sweating. The bee is drawn to sweat, particularly on your face and around your eyes, and it invades the pupil of your eyes. Brazilians call them eye lickers.
Oh, God.
Also a really great song, Eye Lickers.
I think a great band name.
Mm-hmm.
Just gonna say the Eye Lickers.
Poisonous ants that cause vomiting and intense fever. Rats the size of a pig. Literally, imagine the size of a pig.
This reminds me of The Princess Bride, where they go into the forest. There's flames shooting out at irregular intervals. There's flames shooting out of the ground. And then there are those, what is it, rats of whatever it is. That's crazy.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy what is there. And so they have all of this to contend with. And you have a few other things. Number one, Fawcett had a strict rule. If a man got sick, you abandon them.
Oh, boy.
You have to. Because if you do not abandon them, you risk the lives of everyone else.
This is very climbing Everest.
That's right. Yeah. It's very much that.
Yeah.
So they cannot carry you out. You know that going in. If you get hurt or if you get sick, you're dying alone.
This is because they're going on without you. Cammy, and this is very cinematic.
They, and then mutiny was a danger because guys on your trip, you may be leading them to do a certain task that they've agreed to do, but you have hunger, you have deliria, you have, people not wanting to leave others behind, and you have the possibility that your whole group is going to turn on you. And so you have to be sure that you're going in with really loyal people.
Wow.
And so contributing to this idea of larger than life, so knowing all of those things that could happen to you, the training guide at the Royal Geographical Society, and this is very much of the times, it's totally barbaric, but these were the things you were supposed to do. If you were bitten by a poisonous snake, you were advised to pack the wound with gunpowder and explode it.
Oh,
if you were hit by a poisonous arrow and had a hemorrhaging wound, you were told to pour boiling grease into it.
Oh,
right? I mean, this is just 100 years ago.
I should have put a trigger warning before that. That's
really intense. I'm sorry. Did that upset you?
No, I'm not upset, but I can imagine a sort of person who might be the now imagine this. You get bit by a fill in the blank and you tap a little gunpowder into it and explode a part of your body.
That's right.
I have
to
never
get that poison out.
Never heard of that ever.
Strangely, it didn't continue on.
It did not stick.
No, didn't stick. Maybe didn't work. Oh, I'm not sure.
Wow.
But that
I love that it made it into a manual though.
It did, right? That led to
that
this idea.
Manual
of the when you talk about like these guys who did get it done, you know, our thoughts about, you know, a number of other things aside for a moment, they got the job done and contended with all of this stuff, and then the solutions to this stuff were even worse, you know, and it does make you realize like what they went through, I think, to make this happen. So on top of that, the danger was amplified by the fact that he was conducting his expeditions during this era, this bloody era known as the rubber Amazon boom. Because of the development of cars and tires elsewhere in the world.
Yes, I was going to ask about this.
Rubber was high in demand. And so the Amazon is full of rubber plants. So these tire companies would send their people down and they would force the native people and the indigenous people to work for them. And if they resisted, they were often massacred.
Oh my God.
Accounts are shocking. Supposedly there's at least one account of over 30,000 people being massacred.
Oh, it's horrific.
Why don't we know about that? That's a spark in and of itself.
Oh.
Like how did the rubber industry come to be?
That is a
who paid the price
spark.
For it, right?
Oh.
So there's a spark. But because these assholes would come down, enter the Amazon, and do very cruel things to the people there, anyone else who was white who entered the area was now even more at risk because...
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, if you were a native person, you know, a lot of those tribes started to ambush white people on the spot because they didn't know, you know, what are your intentions here? So even if you came in peace, you were now in more danger thanks to that.
God.
So there's like so much. And Colonel Fawcett was different in a lot of ways. Like there were other expeditions going down to map the area or going down to find mythical places, like El Dorado, the City of Gold, etc. And they would bring, and I'm not exaggerating, 4,000 people into the jungle, ships to go down the Amazon, loaded with supplies, loaded with everything they need, hydroplane, etc.
Oh boy.
And 4,000 people died. Like you could assume that the majority of the people in your group were going to die. So Colonel Fawcett would travel with very, very few people. He thought it was easier to live off the land.
Yeah.
He also could convince the tribes of people that he met that they were not there to hurt them. And this was also something that was very, very different about him. He interacted peacefully with the indigenous people. And that was not very common at the time, as I just mentioned. But there's a famous moment that his men describe, like in their journals that live on. And they describe encountering an Amazonian tribe and they were being shot at. And Fawcett made them all drop their weapons. He raised his hands up in the air. He had a handkerchief around his neck. He took that off, lifted his up, and had his men were singing God Save the Queen as he like was essentially waving a white flag.
Yeah.
Very cinematic moment, but he was, many people say that was emblematic of his approach. He would absolutely insist, like his people never shot at any humans that they encountered, and they would have to set their guns down if they were face to face with a tribe of people. And those people might have spears and arrows coming toward them, and still, so the instinct is, it's pretty scary to put your weapon down in that moment. But he was like,
put your weapon
down.
That's
what we're going to do. We're going to put our weapons down. So he was operating in a time when, you know, obviously indigenous people were still treated as, quote, savages in the civilized areas of the world. And he disagreed with that approach. He behaved with respect and humble courtesy when he encountered the tribes in the jungle. And he also learned to bring gifts to honor the elders and ensure like safe passage through the hostile territory.
So am I, you know, I also have, I'm frankly suspicious of, you know, when you told the story, I was like, I'm just going to, you know, stay open and reserve judgment. But is the, you know, pivot going to be that he actually was there to colonize? And I've had this like sort of question of, was he truly there as a, somebody who was really like exploring, cartographing, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing you say is by multiple accounts, that was truly.
That's right. Well, so it's funny because I have a note here in this exact moment where I'm like, listen, I don't know if he was 100% honorable person.
Yeah.
I, you know, there's no way
right,
we'll know that.
Right, right, right.
But we do know he was an outspoken opponent of the destruction of native cultures through colonization. He was very vocal about it. That was not his goal. And like even that story that seems really self-aggrandizing, he didn't write that story about himself. The men who were with him wrote the story. And they tacked on, this guy's fucking crazy. You know what I mean? They were not like, isn't he amazing? Yeah. They were like, this fucking guy, why did I sign up for this?
And that's the threat of mutiny.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
My God.
Yeah. So he was interested in learning about past civilizations and the ones that currently live there. He made sure that people knew that they were not bad. Like when he would report back, he said this, my experience is that few of these, quote, savages are naturally bad unless contact with savages from the outside world has made them so. You know, I think he was one of the few people around that time arguing that outsiders like himself could do more harm than good to the indigenous people if they didn't approach this carefully. So during his travels, he saw things and wrote about things like ancient pottery, traces of what he thought were like causeways and roadways. And he began to form this very strong opinion that the Amazon once contained large populations and at least one, if not more, advanced civilization. He was certain of it. And he became passionate. Of course, he was aware of like in the 1500s, Spanish conquistadors claimed that civilizations existed in the Amazon. But a lot of people in history had discounted that, saying like, yeah, but that's because like the king paid for their trip and they went back and told the king what the king wanted to hear. So they didn't necessarily believe that was true. But Fawcett became very convinced of it. And around 1911, he really believed that he was about to find this ancient city, and he was mapping a route to it for several years, and then World War I began. So despite the fact that he was nearly 50 years old, he volunteered for the front and fought in World War I, and he was awarded a Distinguished Service Order for that. So that, I'm sure, is a whole story in and of itself.
When we're talking about these people, the phrase that comes to mind over and over again is from Amy Poehler's book, Big Wave Rider. This is a big wave rider.
Big wave rider. Holy crap.
In a way, I'm going to be honest, I will never be. But bless that there are people like this that are big wave riders.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness there are,
I'm telling you, Camion, this is a Hall of Fame spar. I'm telling you.
Well, it gets better. So after the war, 1920, he went right back to Brazil to search for this lost city. But the first trip back, he got really, really sick. He ended up in a place that he called Dead Horse Camp because he was delirious with fever and his horse was ailing as well. And so he shot his horse and had to turn back in defeat. But so then that becomes Dead Horse Camp. So he knows, you know, where he was. He got that far. So, like I said, he had studied these Spanish conquistadors who had traveled to the Amazon in the 1500s, and he truly believed believed their stories of finding this civilization. No one else really believed that. And I think it's important to know that. Like, he was alone in this belief.
Yeah.
People thought he was crazy. And like I mentioned before, part of that was racism. Like, they simply didn't believe it was possible.
They could not wrap their minds around it.
That's right. Not possible. And then the food thing. But he believed it. He believed in the idea of El Dorado, the city of gold, based on the stories that he was told and the things that he saw. He didn't really, his interest wasn't in the gold. He believed in this advanced civilization.
And you said that he was seeing some evidence of it in the pottery that remained and things like this. It wasn't just, I had a dream that El Dorado existed. It was something.
Exactly. And remember that he would meet and if he could get to know tribes people in the areas and they would tell stories in their oral histories. So he called the city that he was looking for the city of Z. And
I just got chills.
He became obsessed with disproving these people that thought he was crazy, and he was going to show them that he was right. So his very last journey he spent years preparing for, in 1925, at the age of 57, Colonel Fawcett embarked on an expedition into the Bolivian Amazon. He was accompanied on the journey by his 21-year-old son, Jack.
Oh, no.
And Jack's best friend, Rally Rimmel. And their departure was reported in newspapers all around the world.
Oh, no.
For 5 months, reports came back and everything was touted, everything that they were doing, everything that they saw. They would travel deeper and deeper into the jungle, and then a porter, someone with them or a tribesperson that they met that was willing to do it, would dispatch. They would send a dispatch back, and that person would have to travel back through the jungle to get back to the nearest point of civilization, right?
The journey of that 24 hours in the life of that herald.
That's right. And even everything that you write, you don't know if it's going to actually end up. You're sending a letter to your wife or to a newspaper. You don't know what happens to that person.
They walk away. Of a chihuahua spider.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Crazy. But if all went according to plan, the dispatch would be sent to the newspapers by telegraph, and it would run everywhere around the world. So after 5 months...
This is an amazing reality show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
After 5 months, the dispatches stopped coming. His disappearance was one of the biggest stories of its time. Literally no one believed that he could be dead. They just would not.
Yeah.
They had not. He had survived everything else.
Hero, yeah.
Exactly. So what happened to him? All we know is that on May 29th, 1925, before descending into this deeper, even less explored wilderness, Fawcett sent a telegraph by dispatch to his wife, Nina, which read, "I expect to be in touch with the old civilization within a month. You need not have any fear of failure." Mm. Shortly afterwards, Fawcett and his party disappeared, and they were never seen or heard from again. Now, there are on record messages back and forth between heads of countries saying, what are we going to do? We have to go in and save him. We have to send people. Who is there to send, first of all? No one could do what he did.
He would be the person to send.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But he always said, no one should come after me ever on any of his trips. Do not come after me.
Sidebar. Yeah. An amazing piece of historical fiction.
Yes.
They send in Teddy Roosevelt.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Why didn't they think of that? I wonder if they did.
I mean, because
look
who
into
else,
that.
Who
because
else
who
could,
else could?
Could.
Because who else could? Oh no, Teddy had died by then. Dang it.
The ghost of
We're rewriting history.
Teddy Roosevelt.
The bones of Teddy Roosevelt are going in. But for decades, even though Fawcett said, no one should come after me ever, it's too dangerous.
Oh.
For decades, people went in.
Oh.
13 rescue expeditions officially searched for him.
Suicide missions.
Ending the lives of 100 people.
Suicide.
Suicide missions. And so over the years, rumors came out of the jungle.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say, like,
you're vibrating.
It's so interesting that I am. He went in to find what he called the lost city of Z.
Yes.
And then he became the thing that people was lost. Were.
That's right. That's right.
It's crazy.
That is so true. Ugh. And it's possible he could have led people right to it. So rumors start to come out of the jungle, and they come out of the jungle for years upon years upon years. But I'll start just chronologically. Like, an unnamed German man reportedly saw the shrunken head of a white man that resembled Fawcett. Mm. Shrunken heads are a whole story in and of itself.
That's a big
story. They are real. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I think it'd be hard to identify someone by a shrunken head.
Yeah. I think it'd be hard.
Okay.
But the fact that you see a white man's shrunken head is first and foremost
more unusual.
Unique. Yeah. Especially in that time period. So Fawcett's bones were supposedly found, but that turned out to be a hoax. Mm-hmm. People theorized that the trio could have been attacked or murdered by rebel soldiers active in the area at the time. His gold signet ring eventually ended up in the possession of a shopkeeper. They could have starved to death, been killed by wild animals, eaten by cannibals, or succumbed to injury or disease. Maybe Fawcett lost his mind and lived the remainder of his life in some peaceful village fathering children. People have claimed to have seen Fawcett or Rimmel many years after their disappearance, although none of the reports were substantiated. In the 1950s, people are still looking for him. A man claimed to have the skeletal bones of Fawcett, and he claimed to have gotten them from the Kalapalo Indians, who were the last to have seen Fawcett alive. That story was then repeated and quote-unquote substantiated by a Swedish explorer in the 1960s. In 1996, a millionaire guy named James Lynch and his son went into the jungle to find out what happened to Fawcett. They were kidnapped by a tribe and eventually escaped. That's a whole spark.
Wow.
Need to look into. In the early 2000s, it was reported that an erotic spirit, like a siren, drew white men deep into the jungle, and that Fawcett had been under her spell, and that he set up a commune and a cult to worship his son Jack.
Oh boy.
And that person claims that she has all this evidence from his letters.
I bet.
So think about this though. At that point it's 75 years after his disappearance.
Come on.
And people are still searching, right? Fascination continues into the present. In the early 2000s, a reporter for The New Yorker was writing a piece about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and ran into a mention of Colonel Fawcett. He Googled Fawcett and found hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of articles about this man that he'd never heard of.
Yeah.
This adventurer, this explorer, and he could not stop. Like, he went into the hole.
Oh.
This man's name, this writer's name, is David Gann. He lives in Brooklyn. David says about himself, "I'm a writer, not an explorer. I don't hunt. I don't camp. In fact, I hate those things. When I began my project, I thought it would be more of a traditional biography, and I would do it in a way that was like suitable to my attributes, which would be researching in the archives and the libraries around the world. But there came a point when I became more and more consumed by the story." Mm. So David compiled an extraordinary amount of information, but one pivotal thing changed the course of his journey. He was able to track down Fawcett's granddaughter, and she invited him over to her house. They talked for hours. At one point, she said, "You really want to know what happened to my grandfather?"
Oh boy.
She led him into this back room with this trunk. She opened it, and inside were these old books, like barely held together with little ribbons. They were Colonel Fawcett's secret diaries and logbooks. It turns out that Colonel Fawcett had been really secretive his whole life. Side spark, he was also a spy for the British government.
Oh, big wave rider.
Right?
Where
big
does he find the
wave
time?
Rider. How does he do
How
it
does
all?
He hold all of this in his mind? This is crazy.
He sent letters to his wife in code. So all the coordinates that people had been searching for him were incorrect. He didn't want his competitors, like Teddy Roosevelt, to know exactly where he was or where he found things. So now David Gann is holding in his hands the actual and the only roadmap to the area that Colonel Fawcett was seen in before he was lost forever.
Oh my God, what's going to happen next?
He had to go. He had to go. David's like, I have
Bookish
to go.
David?
I have the roadmap.
I'm comfortable in the stacks, David.
That is correct.
Oh my gosh.
David was like, now I have to go.
Wow.
He had to look for clues. He had to trace the footsteps. So in he went. And his journey became the book, The Lost City of Z.
Unbelievable.
I effing love this book. And I read it years ago. And could not stop talking about it to the point where people were like, got it. Great, Laura, you love the book. But I loved it. It then became a movie.
Yes.
And I mean no disrespect to Brad Pitt.
I tried to watch this movie. Yeah.
I'm bummed about it because this story is so good. I think, so first of all, the book is David's journey and he flips from present time to past, present past. And the movie just tried to do, parallel quests. And the movie just tries to like just a little straight line of Percy Fawcett. And it just feels so small compared to the man's life.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
That's right. Yes.
So they didn't really capture it. And I mean no disrespect. Brad Pitt produced it. And I do love Brad Pitt. But I want someone to redo it. I want it redone. So David Gann from Brooklyn goes into the jungle. The area where Fawcett was going is now a reservation. And so you have to have a guide. You have to get permission to enter. But he did. And he tried to retrace Fawcett's steps. Some places were covered over in growth at this point. Other places were burned down due to deforestation and looked completely different. Mm. But he foraged on based on the information in this journal. He actually met an indigenous woman in a village who was 100 years old.
Oh, God.
She remembers when Fawcett came through. She was 11 years old at the time. It was a monumental thing for their village to see a white man.
Uh-huh.
And she's probably one of the last people to see him alive.
Wow.
So that was incredible.
David Gann is a spark.
David Gann is an amazing spark.
That
also,
woman is a spark.
Yeah, David Gann has other books as well that probably will make an appearance here on the Spark File.
Thanks, David Gann.
Thanks, David. Further into the jungle, David goes, and these tribes have been able to like preserve their rituals, just less contact with the outside world, you know, because going that deep in is so dangerous and very few people make it. So they have preserved the rituals of their culture, and one of them is the oral history. So they don't write things down, but they have these stories, like long poems, that are spoken over and over and handed down across generations.
I love that. It's a great spark.
It is a great spark. And these were the Kalapalo Indians who some had said killed Fawcett. So he was able to to talk to them directly about it. And they have a very rich oral history. They assured him they did not know, you know, their people did not kill Fawcett, but they do know a bit more about what happened to him. Just a little. Expectations.
But a little more is a little more.
That's right. They preserved the history of Colonel Fawcett and the time when he came to their village with specifics. Like they describe a man playing a recorder, which Fawcett always took with him to just combat the silence or the, he would bring music into the jungle. And they describe days with him until the man said, I have to be going. They describe the direction he went in, which was further into Indian territory. They describe how they warned him not to go that way.
Oh.
But after he did, they saw smoke from his fire the first night. And they were like, okay, great.
There he is.
And then further away the next night and further away, and they saw smoke for 5 nights, and then it went out.
No more smoke.
No more smoke. And
that's a beautiful storytelling.
Mm-hmm. And the smoke went out.
That's beautiful, yeah.
And David Gann believes that their ancestors were the last, the very, very last to see him alive. He most likely was killed by hostile tribes further into the jungle. You just have to realize, like, the further in you went, very likely they'd never seen a white person. You come upon them and it could be terrifying. Like, they could kill you for any number of reasons. Yeah. You know what I mean? So on this trip, David also met an archaeologist who had conducted his own research on Fawcett, who was living with the Kalapalo Indians at the time. And this man led David into the jungle and showed him a moat that was built in 1200 AD. And David was able to see that proof for himself while he was there. What's amazing is that now archaeologists working in the Amazon have found remarkable evidence of ruins, ancient ruins, in the area where Fawcett disappeared and where he was looking for the city of Z. They found 20 pre-Columbian settlements connected by causeways. They had evidence of bridges, moats, elaborate irrigation systems.
Wow.
They would have had populations that certainly would have compared to, like, European cities of the time.
Wow.
Now, satellite imagery findings show these massive earthworks that are laid out in, like, geometric form. A glorious civilization could and most likely did exist in the Amazon jungle, like, rivaling anything the Egyptians did with the pyramids. And it saddens me now. I remember a couple of months after I read the book, I saw a headline that a satellite captured.
Uh-huh.
But that, this gets me choked up every time, but it only could be seen by satellite because we have destroyed so much of the forest. So now it's totally visible to us.
Yeah.
But it's such a fucking drag why it's visible to us. So it's nice to know that we, you know, we can learn about the people who live there, but I am very, very saddened as to
how
we're finding out.
Yeah.
But Colonel Percy knew what he was talking about. He was not crazy. And so what do we make of this?
What do we make of it? Well, David Gann's made some stuff out of it.
Gann's made some real stuff.
But what else do we make out of it?
I mean, obviously there's stories, there's man versus nature, adventure stories, but I think there's also some activist art that has to happen regarding the deforestation, like, something to help people understand the value of the area and everything the Amazon
and the story
gives to
of
us.
What has been lost.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing. As you were talking, I've sparks just stacking
sparks, sparks,
up.
Sparks. I know.
They're stacking up. I'm not going to be able to remember all of them,
but I
am struck by how this is a real life hero's journey.
Mm-hmm.
It is the hero's journey. When you're talking about like the eyeball liquors and then, you know, the next night I'm being attacked by vampire bats and then I come face to face with a 62-foot anaconda, like, and then it really is like trial after trial after trial.
That's right.
It really
and
is
they get bigger and bigger.
Classic hero's journey.
Yep.
But one that played out in real life, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
I want to believe, I love that it sounds like the evidence points to this person not being just like another white colonizer, but
that's right.
But somebody who really was seeking
knowledge
and connection and understanding.
100%. He was not there to disrupt.
That's so many sparks. One spark, at first I was like, who? I kind of was like, I think someone's played this, but what is the casting? Like, who plays this person? And I'm almost like, this person is bigger than Brad Pitt. This person is like just in physical stature. And I don't know what Percy Fawcett looked like, but I don't even know who the actor is that plays this person. But I think they would have to be just like extraordinary, charismatic, I don't even know who it is. I sat here trying to think of who it is. I'm like, this is bigger than Hugh Jackman. This is bigger. Like,
I know.
Feel like it's somebody extraordinary. Don't know who it is.
And you've named some extraordinary people already, but.
Daniel Craig? You're like bigger. I need it bigger. Bigger still. Bigger.
Yeah.
So I don't know who that magic person is. But then I thought it might be interesting whether it's a song, a play, a different screenplay, to share a story that's not necessarily Fawcett as the center of the story or the narrative in the song, but it's from the perspective of that 100-year-old Indigenous woman.
That's right.
Or from the perspective of the herald, that the last herald that was sent.
I think about like the child who is anxiously awaiting the newspaper or a radio bulletin, like the people at home hearing this story through these headlines as well. Like that's a really clear picture in my mind.
The
wife.
Yeah, the Indigenous person who turns and then all of a sudden is face to face with one, not just one white person, but like
multiple,
and being like, I have to defend my own life. There's, I just think, what if it's not, what if he's not the central figure? Yeah. It's like, what if it is?
Yeah. Well,
the rainforest,
the
like,
rainforest,
what if it's about,
and what the rainforest has seen? Oh my God. But when you were talking about the hero's journey, like David Gann, his book is like a dual hero's journey because he began his quest when he discovered. So he has his own journey to what, and he said the same thing that you did about the city of gold, the lost city of Z was what we were searching for. But then now, Fawcett became
Percy
the
Fawcett
focus.
Is what we're searching for.
Yeah.
There's something about, I mean, there's so many sparks in this, like the Five Nights of Smoke.
Yes.
It's like, it's a poem. It's a song.
And what's with that millionaire that took his son into the jungle in the 90s? Remember that Teddy Roosevelt also brought his son into the Amazon and they almost died. Like what is it with this father-son thing?
Something about,
like there's so much.
I think there's a hubris in it. People thinking that they'll be the ones that will best this. There's something also about the rainforest that, I mean, it seems like the holdout, like, and it sounds like man is doing their very level best to take it down, but that the rainforest is just like, go fuck yourself.
That's why I like this idea of like doing something from the perspective of the rainforest, because we sometimes get an image of the rainforest as a gentle, yes, it's a wet
pity-pat of the canopy. And
and it's symbolic of peace in some way. And in actuality, that shit can turn on you.
Oh.
And so it is really interesting to think of it as a full character that embodies, you know, peace and danger and glory and failure and defeat.
I was thinking about your show Alone, the show you love on History Channel that I've still never seen. Have they ever put somebody in the rainforest?
No.
I think it's too dangerous.
I think you might be right. Camion, I honestly think you might be right.
This is a world-class spark.
Thanks. I want to like huge, enormous shout out to David Gann, who I'm a huge fan of. I did read his book and I saw the movie and I watched a speech that he gave at the Museum of Science and then a million other sources like the History Channel, obviously. There, like, that's the beauty of it. There's lots to find here. If you want to search for it, it's out there. And who knows, you might find a bigger piece of the puzzle.
You know what? Another spark is surfacing in my mind when we did the story about Lynn Cox.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that she did a whole series of swims that were inspired by the great explorers of the world?
Oh, I wonder if she did one.
I think she did. I don't know if she did one inspired by Percy Fawcett. I can't remember, but it might have been.
Well, shit, she would be swimming in some piranha-filled, anaconda-filled waters. But wow.
There's a lot of ways these explorers and somebody like Percy Fawcett
and
the rainforest can be sparked. I feel like we could just end the episode right here.
We'll never know exactly what happened to him. Only the Amazon knows.
Only the Amazon knows. This is Sparks on Sparks on Sparks on Sparks. We could end the episode now, but we're not going to.
No, I want to hear your
spark. We're going to take a break.
Okay.
And we'll be right back. The Spark Pod!
Blackwell.
We're back.
We're back.
Here we go.
Here we go. I can't wait to hear it.
Cammie, and that spark was so good.
Thank you.
We'll see if this measures
Yes,
up.
It will.
It's not a competition.
It's not a competition.
My spark title today is A Creative Room of One's Own.
Ooh.
My spark sources include The Moth Radio Hour, CaraDeLaLuz.com, a YouTube video by the artist Andrew Tischler, good old Wikipedia, and some other sources I'll cite in just a moment.
Nice.
My initial spark for this came from my sister, Julie.
Hi, Julie.
Hi, Julie. Julie sent me a link to a piece from the Moth Radio Hour, which is a great podcast. Hello, Moth Radio Hour. Shout out to you. You're so good. Julie's message said, I was just listening to this moth story by CaraDeLaLuz that made me think of something. CaraDeLaLuz is a fancy poet / activist, and the moth story is really about her dad and his hoarding, but that is not the spark. The idea that she mentions right at the end is how she has cleaned out his garage and made a creative space. That is the spark that needs to be investigated.
Love it.
Thank you for the spark, Julie. Let's learn more about CaraDeLaLuz and her story. So CaraDeLaLuz, a.k.a. La Bruja, is a New Yorican poet, a playwright, an actress, and an activist. She is considered one of the leading spoken word poets in the world. On the Moth Radio Hour, she told a story called El Garaje, and in it, she tells how she was born in the Bronx, and when she was 5, her parents bought a house in the Bronx that had a backyard filled with beautiful trees. And then her dad, who was a mechanic, bought the house next door that had a huge 50-foot by 50-foot trucking garage behind it. El Garaje.
Uh-huh.
Early on, her parents, she talked about a party that her parents held in El Garaje. And then the years passed, and her dad started collecting stuff in the garage. Then slowly, their house started filling up with stuff. Like, if CaraDeLaLuz threw away a broken toy, it would end up back in the house. 9 years later, spoiler alert, this reminds me of the first season of American Horror Story. Did you watch it, Camion?
I did
not.
The Murder House?
Where,
I'm sorry.
So here was the conceit in that. If you were a ghost haunting that house, you couldn't leave the grounds of the house. And for instance, you would run out the front door and end up entering in the back door. It was really cool the way they did it, where you would you'd be like, I'm getting out of this crazy house. And you'd run out the front door and it would cut to entering through the back door. Like you could not escape it. It was done really, it was a great,
wow.
Sorry, spoiler, 9 years later. Except in
I've had my time to check it out.
Except in CaraDeLaLuz's story, if you try to, for instance, throw out a teddy bear, it just ends up back on your bed.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So back to El Garaje. As stuff accumulated over the years, underneath all of her dad's stuff, there was eventually this whole other ecosystem that was rocking with dogs and cats and rats and raccoons. Eventually, her dad ended up spending more time in Puerto Rico, where he was also hoarding. But after 3 years of her father's being absent, CaraDeLaLuz got a 30-yard metal dumpster delivered to the house, and she started throwing things out. And she said she was throwing things out with gusto, like Michael Jordan dunking a ball. I mean, she goes, she was throwing out dead raccoons. She was cleaning.
But wait,
house.
Her dad was still alive at this point. But was he in Puerto Rico?
But he had been there for 3 years, and after 3 years, she was like "I'm
good.
Doing this.
We're done."
She said she started to see the floor of the garage. She started to see the ground and the grass. And when her father returned from Puerto Rico and saw what she had done, he said, "You threw away my dreams." And then he headed back to Puerto Rico, but he was like, "I'll be back and I'm going to fix this." But CaraDeLaLuz stayed. And she fixed up El Garaje, and she described the newly cleaned space using words like lights, clarity, beauty, happy. And she said that even though her father said that she had thrown away his dreams, she knew that she had just started living hers. Now, of course, you know, the story speaks to me. As many of you know, I love my parents very much. They are seriously wonderful people. And as many of you also know, I come from a hardcore hoarding house. So Caridad's story about just going ham on that hoarded out garage really rocked my world.
Wow.
I live vicariously through you, Caridad. In her message, my sister Julie said, I think that making space, either physical, mental, time, whatever it is so important to being creative. I've been thinking about this for a while, but haven't really thought about it in this way until I heard Caridad's story. Julie's message and Caridad's story totally sparked me, and the timing of it was perfect. I've been working on making my own creative space for the past few months. I have a lot that I still want to do, but I'm slowly getting there. My creative space is a little alcove that's carved out of our guest bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided that it's going to have all of the things that I love in it. All my thrift store stuff, bright colors, my kitschy stuff that I love, stuff that maybe isn't necessarily Nathan's cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
I can have it in my
space. That's right. That's yours.
So the previous occupant of this room was a elderly woman, and it was painted two colors, and I'm going to call those colors pale pea soup and sort of a Malibu Barbie tan. You can picture that. My design spark for the space has been provided by, I was watching that Netflix show, Interior Design Masters. It was a competition. Did you happen to watch that? It was made in the UK. The designer is named Ju De Paula. She is on Instagram at Blueberry Living Co.
Okay.
Her designs are bright. They're super colorful, and they're this blend of sophistication and kitsch.
Mm-hmm.
And
I like where this is headed.
Yeah. So what I would like to do is take the walls away from pale pea soup and Malibu Barbie tan and take them to clean white. So it's just like a clean backdrop for all of this like crazy color and kitsch. I want to replace the light fixtures where they're totally a hodgepodge. They were installed at various eras in the house's life, starting in the 80s and moving through the decades. It's just a museum of lighting fixtures through the decades. I want to replace the flooring, which I will call currently dog pee carpet. But I don't just want to make it pretty to me. I also want to make it super inspiring and super functional.
Yeah.
So I started rooting around trying to find some guiding sparks to creating a creative space of one's own.
Mm-hmm.
And I started with the most famous words on the topic. A room of one's own.
Yes.
This is from our friend Wikipedia. A Room of One's Own is a long essay by Virginia Woolf, first published in September 1929. The work is based on two lectures. I didn't know this. The work is based on two lectures Woolf delivered at women's colleges in October 1928. It's considered an important feminist text. The essay is noted in its argument for both a literal and figurative space for women's writers within a literary tradition dominated by men.
Mm-hmm.
The title of the essay comes from Woolf's conception that a woman must have money and a room of her own if she is to write fiction. At this moment, I just want to acknowledge that this conversation is a really privileged conversation.
100%.
To even consider having a space of one's own, a creative, let alone a creative space of one's own.
That's right.
In her book, what were we
to say? I was going to add to that, though, as they describe, they also mean figuratively, not just literally. So in those cases where we cannot have a literal room of one's own to find that mental space that is just for you.
Yeah. In her book, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, Womenist Prose, Alice Walker wrote, Virginia Woolf wrote that in order for a woman to write fiction, she must have two things, certainly, a room of her own with key and lock and enough money to support herself. Alice Walker goes on to write, what then are we to make of Phyllis Wheatley, a slave who owned not even herself?
Mm-hmm.
who, had she been white, would have been easily considered the intellectual superior of all the women and most of the men in the society of her day.
Mm-hmm.
Walker recognizes that the enslaved woman, Phyllis Wheatley, is in a position far different from the narrator of Wolfe's essay, and that she does not own herself, much less a room of her own. Although she calls attention to the limits of Wolfe's essay, Walker, in Uniting Women's Writing, pays homage to Wolfe's similar endeavor of seeking space, room for women's writers. So she's saying,
right,
Virginia Woolf, there are, you weren't taking everything into consideration.
That's right.
But
that's
you
right.
make a good point when it comes to the conceit of the endeavor to seek space, room for women writers.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to say all of this as a way to acknowledge this is a privileged conversation in a variety of ways.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, I think it's possible in 1928 that, you know, she sadly, due to the times, she wasn't even thinking beyond.
Yeah.
I mean, for a white woman to be able to be a writer, the money aspect, you know, they depended on brothers and husbands to, you know, because they couldn't either make their own money or have it handed down to them. So, you know, I'm sure she was egocentric and white centric in her thinking at that time.
Yeah.
And Alice Walker is completely right to say, that's just a small part.
There's another little side piece I just want to mention because we're here and I was thinking about it. One of the essays in Virginia Woolf's piece is entitled Judith Shakespeare, and it envisions that Shakespeare had a sister named Judith. It reminded me so much of your spark.
I want to.
Like, she wasn't given it reminded me so much of the spark that you did.
She wasn't given
those privileges. Mm-hmm. And so she plays out, so then what? What becomes of the sister that didn't have the privileges of William Shakespeare?
I would also like to point out that very sadly, we are still having these conversations about what if all the girls on this great earth had access to education, because they do not. We're still fighting that battle. So we are still keeping women in the dark, unable to read.
Activism
still
sparks.
To this day.
Activism sparks.
That's right.
Okay. As we know from Lin-Manuel in our conversation with him, it's possible to write portions of Hamilton on top of a rumbling dryer. We don't have to be super precious about where we make, but let's be real. I'm sure that a significant portion of Hamilton was also written in Lin's office and other quiet spaces where he could work without interruption.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, they write best on their feet, working stuff out while they walk, or in front of an audience, for instance. But for some people, whether you're a writer, a singer, a person who works with their hands, someone who works with special tools or materials or equipment, or someone who makes physical work like a choreographer. Or Andy Pugh. You need to carve out some space, the Tinkerage.
Mm-hmm.
Like my sister Julie said, that could be physical space. That could be time. That could be mental space. It could be a laptop. It could be a journal. It could be a rented dance studio. It could be a quiet pod at the library. As I seek to build out my space, I wanted to investigate what would make for the best creative space possible. What I discovered at first is that a lot of sites want to sell you stuff. They want to sell you scented mists to foster your creativity or framed prints with creativity quotes on them. And I'm not against any of that, but for the purposes of this spark, I want to focus on what concepts I should be considering when carving out a space of one's own.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be tricked into thinking that I have to spend a bunch of money on the trappings of creativity. What I really want to focus on is creating a space that really fosters creativity.
Right.
This is going to be different for everyone, but here's some things that I found helpful. In a YouTube video, artist Andrew Tischler shared the story of downsizing from a very spacious art studio into a much smaller room in temporary housing. He said that though the space was smaller, he had room for everything he needed. He said since he didn't have the luxury of wasted space, everything in the studio had an essential role. And if it didn't have an essential role and a specific location in the studio, it didn't make it into the studio. So side spark for, you know, this camps for about 20 years, I lived in a very small New York City studio with another grown ass adult. So
that is correct.
I know small spaces.
You sure do.
And Andrew's right on the money. Like everything has to have a function, if not multiple functions, and there has to be a home for it. Otherwise,
that's right. Chaos I remember ensues. That from that time period. And it's still to this day, Wes and I will reference it from time to time. It's like, remember what Susan said, everything has a home. It has a place where it's supposed to go back to when it's being put away, not just shuffled around.
It was like living on a ship.
Yeah.
It was like living on that's a right. boat. Like, it, yeah. So yeah. Andrew is a painter who works in oils. So this information is specific to his type of creative work. Mm-hmm. But that being said, Andrew's main considerations were, number one, functional zones. This dictates the layout. Andrew is a visual artist, so he has specific zones for things like painting, graphic design on his computer, sculpting, business stuff, reading slash research slash reflection, and stretching canvases slash construction, right? So he has a very specific concept of what he needs to accomplish in this very small space, and he has created zones for each of those things. He used black soft goods to tack to the wall, and then he attached a full wall easel to the wall with minimal drilling so that it can be easily patched when they move out of this temporary housing. But he has, instead of just like an easel that's sitting on the ground or the table, he has like a full wall easel for these, you know, either several paintings or a significant painting of size. Lighting. All of the lighting in Andrew's studio is super functional, so he can really see the work he's doing. The light is calibrated as close to white as possible, and some of it is set up so he can see what a painting will look like in a gallery setting. He stressed that all the lighting in his office is the most affordable option available at the hardware store, or secondhand, or free.
Wow.
So it's...
it's not about like spending bucks.
Yeah.
It's, you know...
it really is about
functionality.
Like functionality. Ventilation. If you're working with materials that require ventilation, this is an important step. Mm-hmm. Some of you can pass on to the next step, but a properly installed bathroom fan costs about $30 and can remove fumes and propel them outside. Mm. He even has directions on how to install a ventilation fan in your studio if it's necessary. Even though it was temporary housing, he drilled into some surfaces. Like I think he's showing himself drilling through an interior door to create this airflow. But he said, ask forgiveness, not permission. I was like, okay, the next step for Andrew, storage. He smartly says that as an artist, his most precious resource is time. So he tries to be super organized because he doesn't want to waste that precious time looking for something he needs, knows he has, but cannot find. He keeps all of his supplies in one cabinet with drawers that look like it looks like about the size of a small dresser. There's a place for everything. Everything is in its place. I have to say, this is an area where I feel like I could do better. I have a tendency to let papers pile up, and I need to work on that and some other storage elements. This is definitely a work in progress, but I was like, I like this idea that he has about like knowing what your assets are and then conceiving of a way to really store them.
I think also being realistic about it seems important because in times when I've been like optimistic about how much storage I need, then you do find like you're accumulating stuff and it's sitting in the zone that's supposed to be your workspace.
Right.
And every time you have to shuffle things around to clear out the workspace
again. I have
again.
A little bit of that right now that I want to remedy. Inspiration. Andrew consciously puts things up in his studio that are intended to spark his words, to spark his next project, or even just give him a good feeling when he walks into his studio. So he has cork boards up in his office where he can tack things, like things that he's working, graphic arts, things he's working on the computer, he can print them and tack them up so he can be reminded of them and see them. He has various objects in his studio that inspire him, like his first oil painting that he did when he was 10, his father's bronze sculptures, and other things that put a smile on his face and inspire him in some way. I fucking feel this, and I've made a decision in my little creative space that I want everything that my eye lands on to inspire me in some way or make me feel positive in some way. So I've got my monster paintings up, my put a monster in it, like my thrift store paintings where I put monsters into them. And all of the things that I really love are like out on display. So everywhere my eye lands, I'm like have this like puff of positive feeling.
You're making me feel nostalgic because my space in Florida was exactly that. And I did. And Wes was like, do what you will. Do what, like, he literally was like,
a room
it's great.
Of your own.
And no judgment about, like, I put up only things that made me feel happy about things I had done, experiences I had, things I want to do in the future, all of it. And I'm not working in that space anymore, but happiness.
So if you don't have much space to work with, you can do like several of my friends have done and make a cloffice. And that is an office or a studio inside of a closet. The first person I knew who had a cloffice was composer Jeff Bowen. He has this smart little desk with a computer set up inside their walk-in closet. And it is still, it is their closet.
It's still where he writes.
And it's filled with clothes and closet shoes and closet stuff. And also he has carved out this space, which reminds me of a very cozy, like, you know how dogs like to go in their little kennel? Like they have, POTUS has his little pod. And when he needs his time, he goes into his pod. We'll be watching a movie and he'll leave us to go have a little alone time. And this, it reminds me, there is like a sound, because of the clothes, there's sound dampening in Jeff's cloffice. And it's, it reminds me, it's very cozy and productive. My friend Ashley Van Buren, who we all have to thank for that wonderful Brundabar spark, Ashley has a cloffice too. And she said, the idea for her cloffice came from both Jeff Bowen and her production supervisor friend, Betsy Alton. They are both the masters of the cloffice. Ashley said, I like that it's a space where I can work that is not my coffee table, couch, or breakfast bar. I also like that it makes me feel enclosed, which helps me focus and bang out the little things I tend to procrastinate on a whole lot faster. The downside is that my lighting situation sucks in there because there's no outlet. Push lights and rechargeable lights don't last long enough and don't throw enough light where I really need it. It's not a proper desk. It's just an old Alpha 4 drawer frame. So it's annoying to try to move my legs around once they're inside the frame. So it's basically limited mobility. Another downside is that she had to downsize her clothing. She had to make some hard choices about her wardrobe to make room for it. But I asked her, if you had to choose to get the closet space back or keep the cloffice, which would you prefer? And she said, oh, I'd keep the cloffice for sure. But you don't even have to have room for a cloffice. I challenge you, how can you carve out a creative space with what's available to you right now? Again, it could be your laptop. It could be a journal. It could be a set of good earplugs. Could it be a lap desk or a quiet spot at the local library? Could it be setting time aside? Could it be 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week, non-negotiable, that is yours to create with no matter where you do it?
That's a big step right there. That's a huge step in the right direction.
Sometimes I think it's helpful to have a ritual that denotes that it's time to create. I have a mechanical candle on my desk that I turn on at the top of creative work and it gets turned off when I'm done. It's maybe your version of saying out loud, I'm finished, and like shutting, you know, turning off that candle. In her book, Bird by Bird, Anne Lamott says, I sit for a moment and then say a small prayer. Please help me get out of the way so I can write what needs to be written. Sometimes rituals quiet the racket. Try it. Rituals are a good signal to your unconscious that it is time to kick in. You might also consider trying to breathe. If you try to follow your breath for a while, it will ground you in relative silence. In Linda Berry's writing class, before we would embark on any writing exercise, every time we started a new exercise, she would read the following poem to us, written by the 13th century Persian poet Rumi. You are sitting here with us, but you are also out walking in a field at dawn. You are yourself the animal we hunt when you come with us on the hunt. You are in your body like a plant is solid in the ground, yet you are wind. You are the diver's clothes lying empty on the beach. You are the fish. In the ocean are many bright strands and many dark strands, like veins that are seen when a wing is lifted up. Your hidden self is blood in those veins that are lute strings that make ocean music. Not the sad edge of surf, but the sound of no shore. When she read that poem, I think Linda Berry was preparing us to create from a subconscious place and mm-hmm. to follow the stream of consciousness and to let the pen go wherever it wanted to go, aka to let the monkey drive the speedboat and for us to be the water skier following behind, taking dictation. She was giving our subconscious the green light, the permission
That's right.
to go on and create.
Yeah.
Like the artist Andrew Tischler said in his studio setup video, ask for forgiveness, not permission. That goes for making a creative space of your own too. If you still need it, we give you permission to make a creative space of your own using the resources that you currently have at your disposal. You know who else didn't ask for permission? Caridad de la Luz. She cleaned out El Garaje in her father's absence, even over the protests of her mother, who knew how mad her husband would be. And Caridad made space for herself. From her website, CaridadDeLaLuz.com, El Garaje is a restored 1920s trucking garage in the Soundview section of the Bronx that has been transformed into a creative art space. Caridad conducts free events and artistic programming at El Garaje. It is also rentable for private events, readings, music band rehearsals, photo shoots, video shoots, and private classes. Among other things, it is equipped with an electric piano, a drum set, congas, electric and acoustic guitars, amps, mics, speakers, a soundboard, a corner stage, lighting, and a mini fridge. It is adorned with a 1940 Burgundy Oldsmobile with suicide doors and Tommy gun platforms and a 1975 VW Bradley GT kit car that has been converted into a DJ booth complete with LED lighting.
Whew.
I am so sparked by Caridad. She's a sparkish example of how to make a creative room of one's own.
Yes.
For yourself and for others.
And for others.
And that is my spark du
jour. Ooh, good spark.
So what do we make of it? I think we make a creative space of our own.
We make space.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. In our schedule,
with time.
In our mind.
That's right. Yep. That's right. That's my spark.
Suze, that's a good spark.
Well,
I think we all need it. You know, even if you have the physical space, have you made the mental space? If you have the mental space, have you
given the permission
and created a physical space for yourself?
I'm very interested in like optimizing, mm-hmm. like taking the time to create a foundation that is just, you know, I love yes. making stuff, but I love the idea of having this.
Oh,
couture
yes.
space.
Oh, yes.
Ah,
wow. That is good. And she is a spark.
She is.
Oof.
And that's just the beginning of the yeah. spark that is yeah. Caridad de la Luz.
I bet.
She would be a great guest.
Oh, let's
Hi,
try.
Come on into the spark. Mm-hmm. But listen, I feel okay. like that is
yes,
it.
That's it.
We hope that this put another bunch of sparks in your file. Listen, if there's a spark you'd like us to explore, or if you've taken a spark and fanned it into a creative flame and you'd like to share it, won't you email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com.
We'll even take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you got to share a creative risk that you have taken recently.
And be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. If you like this podcast, share it with people you love. If you didn't like it, I seriously doubt that you've listened long enough to hear this outro.
If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we're writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
You got to declutter it. You got to homemade peanut butter it. You got to make up your own rhyming words and quutter tutter butter it.
You got to take it and make it.
Bye.
Boy.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark files. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark file.
Did you ever wonder what it would be like to be part of the SparkFile coaching community? Here's how the SparkFile community describes it.
The most honest, safe, life-affirming, and life-changing experience I've had in all my 55 years. The best.
I'm incredibly grateful to Laura and Susan for teaching me the tools and structures that I need to get past the fear and to just do it anyway.
The SparkFile is a portal to your creative powers and believing in yourself.
This group is spiritually, emotionally, mentally
supportive, creative,
amazing, encouraging,
life-shifting, and liberating.
Uber talented, warm, thoughtful, lovely, wonderful people.
I need a group like this to give me the kick in the ass that I need to start making the things that I want to make and do.
This big, beautiful, creative trampoline that just like catches you gently and just launches you out with so much love.
If you want to learn more about the SparkFile Creativity Coaching, including our six-month Blaze course, visit thesparkfile.com/blaze and schedule a no-pressure, no-obligation call to find out what is possible and how we can support you. It's time to take it and make it.